This season on The New Way We Work, I'm going to be looking at the problems with work, how we got here, and how to solve them. For this first episode, the problem with work is management and workers don't see eye to eye.
UPS also announcing it will cut 12,000 jobs.
And Amazon. Amazon and UPS are also among companies mandating office employees to return to in-person work.
It's about efficiency, automation.
We saw PayPal cutting 9% of their world's 2,500 people gone. Microsoft cut 1,900 people from their gaming division.
In the tech sector alone, more than 34,000 people have been laid off so far this year.
Like only the most recent example of labor tensions here in the
More U.S. employees are feeling increasingly burned out at work.
U.S. employees are more unhappy than they were in the thick of the pandemic. And there is a survey data out right now that indicates that people are just feeling kind of uneasy about it.
Welcome back to The New Way We Work from Fast Company, where we take listeners on a journey through the changing landscape of our work lives and explain what we need to build the future we want. I'm Fast Company Deputy Editor Kathleen Davis. Even in the best of times, there's always been an undercurrent of conflict between the priorities of corporate leadership and the needs of employees. But the last several years have been far from the best of times. When the pandemic forced the hand of companies to embrace remote work as a necessity, employees were able to seize the opportunity to work in what is often a more humane way. But instead of embracing remote and hybrid work, countless companies have spent the last 3 years battling and threatening their employees to return to the office. And return to office is just one of the employee management clashes in recent years. There's also been high-profile labor organizing efforts and strikes, a renewed uproar over executive pay, and often missteps in handling layoffs and cutbacks. For this first episode, I'm joined by WorkLife editors Julia Hirst and AJ Hess. Together, we're going to look at the most fundamental problem with work, any type of work, that employees and management don't see eye to eye. And hopefully, together, we can figure out how we can find some common ground. Hi, AJ and Julia. Thanks for joining me again.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hey, good to be here.
So before we get started, you know, we're talking about the clash between management and employees and why they can't see eye to eye and the kind of the difference between the reality and the mood right now. So let's just start with like a vibe check and a mood check of like how we're feeling maybe both personally about work and generally about the world of work. So I will start today. Personally about work, I'm feeling all right. Generally about the world of work, I am feeling kind of anxious. I keep, like everybody, I keep reading all these headlines about, especially about the media business and the AI and search and how the whole model is changing. There's just a lot of depressing headlines about that. AJ, what's your vibe check? What's your feeling?
Personally, my vibe is I feel like I'm sprinting. And then I think big picture, my vibe check is I feel like I'm running a marathon. So I feel like each day feels like I'm kind of rushing to get all my tasks done. But then when I take a moment to take a deep breath and look at the big picture, I get actually more excited. I get hungrier and excited to run the rest of the race. Sorry for the sports metaphors.
It also just feels so polished. You have both sides.
You're like, I've prepared my answer. You have your 30-second pageant answer and you've prepared it well.
And then I have to go after that. That's not fair.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I would say right now it feels a little bit uncertain. I think we're sort of in a position where we're moving between a lot of different things. A lot of stuff is kind of on the radar and potentially happening. As you said, AI, you know, all these layoffs, all of these things. It feels like everything is changing. We're trying to keep up. Hopefully we can help you do that. But yeah, a little bit uncertain, I would say.
Yeah, there's a lot. I think the common thread I'm going to draw through the three of us is there is a lot going on. And it's like what to focus on, what to feel optimistic about, and what to worry about. So we'll break all that down. I wanted to dive into what's on people's minds this year, in particular, the perception that things are really bad right now. Let's first set a baseline with facts. AJ, what's going on in the job market and the economy right now?
The labor market's pretty confusing right now. I would say on the one hand, there have been some really high profile layoffs at tech companies like Google, Microsoft, and Salesforce, and at media organizations like the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and Time Magazine, and retail companies like Amazon, Macy's, Wayfair. Companies like Citibank and UPS also announced layoffs this year. And that's kind of a foreboding sign in my eyes, because those are businesses that touch a really wide range of economic activity. However, on the other hand, as our colleague Pavithra points out, despite all of this macroeconomic turmoil, there are also really, really strong macroeconomic labor figures. The unemployment rate stands at 3.7%. The labor participation rate stands at 62.5%. Then the most recent jobs report, employers added over 300,000 new jobs in January, which was more than analysts actually expected. So there's this kind of confusing picture. And I think that's why, on the one hand, the market might be going well, but people feel like it isn't.
So is it a matter of where these layoffs are just more high profile, and so you hear about the, like, they're just kind of getting more news, than like it's not as interesting to hear that the unemployment rate is 3.7%, or it's not as interesting to hear that there's 353,000 jobs were added. It's like, oh my God, this place all cut jobs. We're in a doom spiral. Like, do we have a negativity bias? Like, why do you think that we're kind of feeling the way we're feeling?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely could be some negativity bias and just some name recognition bias, right? When we hear a company like Google do layoffs, even though they're making such high profits each year, you know, that obviously does make an interesting story. I think the other part of it is that the churn rate, the rate at which companies hire employees and then fire them, is getting faster. And that's really well documented over the past several decades. So what I think is happening is that we're still seeing crazy layoffs, but the funny thing is that they're hiring back cyclically, which is why the unemployment rate stays relatively flat or stable for now.
And some of the layoffs too are, I mean, I hate this term, but they're the, where they always say right sizing, right? Where they're like course correcting for the kind of irresponsible like amount of hiring that they did when, you know, they're just kind of not like smartly going about the hiring and the firing. It's like, we'll hire a bunch of people, now we'll lay off a bunch of people, now we're hiring a bunch of people again.
Yeah, I mean, you even said earlier that there have been some missteps in terms of how leaders have cut back and laid off employees. And, you know, listen, I've written and edited articles on those subjects, but the kind of underlying truth of that is that there's no right way to be firing people as humans. I think we understand that ideally, you're not firing people because you're leading your business with the foresight and the necessary planning to make sure you don't have to do that in the first place.
Well, speaking of like the right way and not right way to fire people, Julia, you've been covering lately kind of this newish trend of recording your layoffs and kind of, I think, I wonder if that's playing into perceptions as well of like the experience is just more public and more talked about in a way that it wasn't before.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. We're just seeing more videos of people deciding to press record when they know that HR call is coming.
There is backlash today after this young woman recorded herself getting fired.
We finished our evaluations of 2023 performance. This is where you have not met Cloudflare expectations for performance. We've decided to part ways with you.
Yeah, I'm going to stop right there.
Sure.
So I started August 25th. I've been on a 3-month ramp, and then it was 3 weeks of December, and then a week of Christmas, and then here we are.
People haven't always spoken openly online, on LinkedIn, about what it means to be laid off and sort of what that experience is like, and, you know, been transparent in the aftermath of that, of looking for work. So that may also be affecting just, you know, what the overall sentiment is about if it feels like a lot of people are being laid off in this time. I think one thing we've been able to see, obviously, with some of those videos is just how badly some HR companies are handling those conversations and how much they're sticking to a script, how much they're not able to empathize and be honest and, you know, sort of get into why people actually are getting laid off, you know, as AJ was talking about, that so often these are decisions that are not based on individual employee performance, that maybe the leaders were just hiring too many people to begin with and then can't sustain that level. And so I think that's been sort of a positive trend that we've seen in just like the transparency around that conversation and the push towards trying to encourage HR and managers in general, just if they are going to have to do layoffs, obviously it's much better not to do them in the first place, but if you're going to have to do them, what that conversation should look like in an empathetic workplace.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge in the push to kind of help reform HR and reform, make work more humane is, you know, hopefully if you are in an HR department and you are having to conduct layoffs, you obviously do not want to be on one of these viral videos having to apologize and justify your actions. I would think that like humanity would make, you know, and human empathy would make you want to go about the layoff in a better way anyways, but if nothing else, then public accountability maybe does. I wonder too, if part of the reason why it seems so many more companies are laying off or layoffs are at this high that they're not exactly is, you know, as you mentioned, you know, AJ, when you listed off the companies earlier, a lot of those are such high profile companies. They're Google, they're the Los Angeles Times, and those employees are also, even if they're not filming their layoffs, they're just more online, public facing sort of employees too.
That definitely could be happening.
So now let's dive a little bit more into that kind of mood and vibe of the world of work right now, because I said, you know, at the top, this is far from been the best of times. There is this like feeling that things are really bad right now. And Julia, last year around this time, you were on the podcast talking about your article about how the age of the empowered employee is over. Well, you asked the question, the headline was a question, but it was kind of like, the, you know, the premise was that we felt we had this like really tiny sliver of time where it felt like the power shift was kind of going towards employees. And it certainly does not feel that way anymore. You know, in that episode, we talked about during the Great Resignation in like late 2021, early 2022, companies were kind of desperate to retain employees and they were scrambling to give employees what they wanted. But then the mood and the power kind of shifted in early 2023. What was happening then, and how does what was happening in 2023 vibe kind of compare to what's going on now?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I wrote this, we were just sort of starting to see or to feel that pendulum was kind of swinging a little bit, that previously employers had been making all these efforts to try to retain employees and do whatever they could to get them to stick around, whether that was, you know, coming up with benefits that felt better to employees or saying, oh, it's totally fine, you can work remotely, that sort of thing. When I wrote this about a year ago, that was definitely at a time when I think a lot of the return to office mandates were really kind of kicking up into the next gear. Companies were feeling like they sort of had the ability to push workers back into the office more than maybe the average worker wanted to. And as AJ said, we've certainly seen a bunch of high profile layoffs since then. So even though employment numbers are still strong, it doesn't necessarily feel like the average employee might have quite the same level of empowerment or feeling like they can sort of demand what they want. And so that might make folks a little bit less likely to quit a job if they don't have another one lined up, you know, like another secure job offer happening.
And I wonder, and I'd love to hear from both of you, like what you're just kind of like feeling on the mood and the vibe is in the world of work right now, because I do certainly feel that there was that moment where it did feel like employees are like, you know what, you don't give me what I want, I will easily find a job somewhere else. And I'm not hearing and feeling that from people so much anymore. It feels like there is the like, and this message is coming a bit from corporate leadership too, of like, you're lucky to have the job that you have. And there's also this, you know, we haven't mentioned it yet, but there's also kind of the specter of AI of like, well, you could be replaced in a way that I think wasn't there in 2021. What do you guys think?
I completely agree that AI is on a lot of workers' minds. I think it's on a lot of employers' minds. So I don't think they're making up that anxiety. I think one of the tensions is that the economy is doing well enough that there are jobs open. It's just what types of jobs people want to work and whether or not the labor market currently fairly pays for those jobs that people don't want to do. So in an ideal system, people are paid a significant amount for the jobs that aren't very fun, right? But, you know, I think as people have come out of the pandemic, they've reassessed their values and they want jobs that, you know, not only pay them well, but also meet some type of work-life balance that also fulfill some type of personal passion or creativity. So I think one of the disconnects that we're seeing is that it feels like there aren't enough good jobs, enough jobs that meet all of these pretty high criteria. And then the reason the unemployment rate is so solid is because there are other jobs. They're just not fun jobs.
I totally agree with that. I think that's right. I guess the like one small silver lining I would point to is just the idea that you can't really like unring some of these bells when it comes to the workplace. Like once people see how, you know, they can be productive in a remote setting, how they can do work more flexibly and not necessarily work 9 to 5. You know, we're definitely seeing that with kind of 4-day work week trends and other kind of shifting around of flexible work. I think all of these things, certain managers and leaders and executives can choose to push back on if they want. But I think the overall trend is definitely pushing towards more flexibility, people being able to come up with like a hybrid arrangement if they're an office worker that works pretty decently for them. Yeah, I just don't think you can unring some of these bells and some of the sort of lessons that we learned from the height of the pandemic.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, you know, and speaking of bosses, I guess kind of the big elephant in the room is executive compensation and how, you know, there's such, I mean, when you ask somebody what makes them happy or unhappy at work, I mean, the, you know, the people they work with, the work they do is certainly up there, the flexibility, those things, but pay always, always, always is towards the top. And in recent years, especially, we have started to see a lot more kind of pushback and a lot of inflation over the kind of astronomical amount that CEOs make when it's compared to the average employee. We actually ran a CEO fair pay report late last year that had a really comprehensive look at how much more CEOs make from their average employees. There were a couple of, you know, really staggering examples in there. AJ, how do you think the kind of astronomical amount that CEOs make factor into the clash between employees and management?
I think it is a major factor in the clash between employees and management. But I actually think it could be bigger. The CEO to worker pay gap has increased steadily over the past decade. Recent estimates suggest that CEOs at one of the top 350 US firms earn $27.8 million per year on average. Now that's almost 400 times what the typical worker earns, but it's also 1,460% more than executives earned in 1978. So it's not just growing between employers and employees, it's also growing between employers of the past and employers today. And the first thing to keep in mind is that workers do not fully comprehend how massive the CEO to worker pay gap generally. And that's pretty intentional. You know, CEOs try to conceal how much they make. They often try to receive the majority of their compensation through bonuses and stock awards to avoid taxes. And when I interviewed professors and researchers on how this impacts workers, they told me that even though workers often underestimate how big the gap between how much they earn and how much their CEO earns, they do perceive the gap to be big enough that it causes what one professor called, quote, emotional damage to employees. And this hurts morale, it hurts company culture. Many said it hurts productivity. So I think it's a huge factor. And I actually think if workers were more aware of how big the gap was, it would have an even bigger role to play in the clash between employers and employees.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think that's really interesting. I know those were some big numbers and a lot of numbers. So I just want to like kind of pause and go back to them. So not only are CEOs earning like 400 times as much as their average employees, but their pay, CEO pay, has gone up, I'm going to read this again, 1,460% over the last like 40, 50 years. So if you were a CEO in the 70s and you're a CEO now, you're making like 1,500% more. And like, you know, I don't know what the numbers are for how like average employee wages have gone up, but I think they're stagnant, right? Or they've adjusted for inflation, haven't gone up that much. Like knowing, and then that point that you made is so, so true. I think everybody has a feeling that like, yes, my CEO makes a lot of money, makes a lot more money than me. But I know that in your article and in this package, we highlighted that like when you would ask employees how much more, they would guess something like, you know, 30% more, 50% more, 100% more or something, but nobody would guess 500 times more than I make. And once, you know, and there's been this push for transparency now. And so now that employees are finding that out, those numbers are publicly available. Yeah, it's making people a lot more upset. What's kind of the action there? What's going on? I know there's been some like shareholder pushback. What's the kind of pushback on executive pay?
Well, on the shareholder level, we've had a pretty high profile case recently in the case of Elon Musk, in which shareholders claimed that it was irresponsible for him to be receiving the payouts that he did. There are increased pushes for transparency. There are I would say on the government level, probably actually not a lot going on there. The one other thing I wanted to bring up, you know, you mentioned comparing how much CEOs made in the 70s to today. And I think that's a really important figure because it shows that it's not that CEOs are getting better at their jobs or working harder, right? Like executives in 1978 worked really hard too. And I'm sure there's a lot of CEOs that work really hard today, but they surely could not be working, you know, 1,460% more than they did back then.
You know, and I think another, when you talked about, what was it, emotional damage about, like, because you think about that, you know, as an employee, when you are, even if you are a well, quote unquote, well compensated employee, even, you know, and we've been covering this increasingly on Fast Company as well, is what kind of a middle class, the belief of, you know, being comfortable in middle class, you're still struggling for, you know, childcare to pay for childcare, housing costs are up, you know, like you don't feel wealthy. You feel like you're still kind of working hard. And then you hear that these CEOs make an amount of money that you just cannot wrap your mind around. And like, what do you even need that amount of money for? What do you even do with that amount of money? And then, yeah, obviously that's going to, you know, cause a lot of resentment, morale. Like you, if you think, and you know, we've covered, of course, a lot of when you find out a colleague makes more than you for doing the same job or a similar sort of job. You think, okay, a CEO's job is harder, but is it that much harder? And yeah, I think that's obviously going to be the cause for a lot of clash. I mean, what's the solution here? I mean, I think transparency certainly helps. Shareholder pushback helps. Yeah, like what else? What could we do?
I feel like a big sort of piece of this is sort of the labor movement, right? I mean, and I know that that's been a central argument for a lot of unions and a lot of strikes has been looking at these kind of outsized CEO compensation packages and how that money could be used differently. AJ, I know that's something that you've spent a lot of time reporting on recently.
Yeah, I got the chance to profile Fran Drescher, who's the president of SAG-AFTRA, and during their negotiations, highlighting how much these studio executives were making was a major part of their comm strategy, a major part of their negotiation. We saw the same points being brought up with the United Auto Workers negotiations. So, you know, if we think about how the majority of executive pay is coming in the form of stock and bonus, not through salary, I think there are a lot of people who, when they think about the future, they think about how the majority of money is going to be transferred as wealth rather than paychecks in the future. And I think that brings really essential, fundamental questions about the future of work, wherein the majority of money that's getting moved throughout the country isn't happening through the amount of time you put into your job. And that is usually the start of the conversation for a lot of people who believe in things like universal basic income.
That's a great point.
Yeah. I'm like, that's going to just make me, like, I want to just chew on that.
So in conclusion, universal.
I know.
Which I don't know a ton about, but usually that's where this conversation goes.
I think like part of that too, and I wonder about how this is, you know, if we're talking about spinning it forward for the next generations and we're talking about how these things are just so much more out in the public now, and Gen Z especially is kind of, you know, not only are they more apt to record their layoffs and publicize that, but they are also coming into a world of work where their blinders aren't on maybe as much as in previous generations. And they're much more wise to all of these kind of inequalities that we didn't talk about anymore. And you know, how do you think that they will kind of spin forth this world of work in a different way and potentially change the way, you know, I mean, universal basic income is a huge dramatic shift, but, you know, maybe this is going to start pushing that inequalities in between average workers and executive. And as we've mentioned, obviously there's the labor movement aspect of it too.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that in general, we're seeing sort of a greater push towards transparency, conversations about salary happening between coworkers, conversations about, you know, what healthy work culture looks like. I mean, I think every time there's a new generation that enters the workplace, like I'm sure this will happen with Gen Alpha when they join too, but there's always sort of this, you know, pushback and people like to talk about how Gen Z is entitled or, you know, and I think some of that may just be the fact that, yeah, a lot of them are more aware of some of these inequalities and a lot of them, I think, are having some sort of fundamental questions about what they want work to look like in their lives, you know, how much value they put into what they're spending, you know, 8+ hours a day doing, and how to do that in a more sustainable way. I mean, I think that's a trend that a lot of people have been seeing sort of since the pandemic, a kind of reassessment of what your working life means and how you want that to fit in with your the rest of your life, the other hours that you are conscious in the world. So yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be sort of some of that pushback of like, oh, Gen Z doesn't want to work. Gen Z doesn't care about these sorts of things. And, you know, I think some of that is just hopefully a larger trend where we can have a more honest conversation about work and compensation and how we're all showing up in the office or online.
I feel like that word entitled is like what every generation uses to gaslight the generation behind them of like, you're entitled, you know, you're just being entitled, where it's like, no, we're actually, you know, because millennials were called entitled, Gen X was called entitled. There, you know, when, as soon as you start to ask for, you know, what you're owed, what's fair, what, you know, some sort of move towards equality, you're being entitled and you should just stay in your lane, do things the way they were done before. You know, it kind of goes back to that, like, I had to work this way. I had to put up with this. You know, I had to pay my dues. I had to do whatever. You know, we saw this a lot with the, like, the different waves of feminism, and I had to play in the all boys club. And so, you know, why do you want things different? You know, why do you expect something different? You're being entitled, that sort of, but really this entitlement, air quote entitlement, is, you know, how we start to move towards the world of work that is more equitable.
I recently interviewed Debbie Levitch, who runs Boston Consulting Group's Future of Work research, about why so many executives were pushing for the return to the office, even though there's this great data to suggest that people are more productive and happier when they have a little bit of flexibility. And she likened it to hazing. She was like, it's like, I had to do this when I pledged the fraternity. And so you should have to too. And I think as we heal as a society, I do tend to think that managers are doing that less and less.
Oh, God. Yeah, that is a great analogy. It really is hazing, because it is like, I had to suffer to get where I am, so you better suffer to get where you are. And it's like, but why? Like, let's break that cycle. But thank you for bringing us back to return to office, because I feel like that's the issue that we keep kind of circling around when we talk about the clash between employees and management. It's the biggest one that keeps coming to mind. We've mentioned it a few times. It's one of the biggest ways that management and employees have been clashing, especially over the last couple of years. You know, I find it, like, on one hand, I find it really surprising that we're still having this debate. Like, we started to talk about return to office, I want to say in 2021, as soon as a vaccine became available. But on the other hand, it's not surprising that we're still having this debate, because it's kind of a metaphor or a cornerstone issue for kind of the biggest clash, the biggest problem between management and employees, which is the issue of control versus autonomy, kind of the old ways of working and the new ways of working. And one of our writers, Jared Lindzen, recently dug into why this debate is kind of still happening and how it will end. Julia, what did he find?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point of, like, in some ways it feels kind of wild we're still having the same conversation. But I thought one of the most interesting parts of this piece that he wrote, which is called "The Return to Office Debate Maybe Settling Down in a Way That Makes Everyone Unhappy," is he talked to some experts, and they were saying basically, like, employers, companies may be ready to, like, move on to other things. They've been talking about this, you know, they want to move beyond return to office mandates and focus on other things. But, like, the average employee's experience is so dictated by how much flexibility they have to schlep into the office every single day and, you know, waste 2 hours on public transit, or, you know, all of these things have such a dramatic impact on an individual worker's quality of life. So of course, workers, like, still want to talk about this. And I do think that we've seen a lot of change in the space, and that, you know, some companies have said one thing and then, you know, maybe there's a surge, or maybe they're seeing a lot of their workers quit because they don't want to continue to show up. And so they've had to sort of reassess how much they're willing to enforce these mandates. So it's not like every company in December 2021 came out with a policy and has stuck to it since then. Like, I think part of the reason we're still talking about it is just because it keeps changing, frankly, and people have feelings about those changes.
We've talked a lot about the, like, huge disconnect between executive leadership and employees. I mean, that's a big one. That's a, like, solve work.
I have some steps that people suggest to address some of these issues include things like stakeholder capitalism, or co-op style working engagements in which workers have a stake or share in company profits so that, you know, even if your salaries may change or your rates may change, that everybody is getting a piece of the pie and working towards the same goal. Another thing in terms of, you know, the tension between employees and managers, one solution that people sometimes point to, I'm not fully endorsing this, but we can already look to the tech industry and look at some examples of how there's a little bit more agency given to individual contributors. When you look at people like software developers, who instead of having like a manager who is their boss, they have a project manager who is kind of actually more horizontal than them. So they may be helping coordinate them or helping them make sure they meet their goals, but they're not necessarily their direct boss. And so I think there are some people who look at that structure that's just a little bit more horizontal and less vertical as a potential path forward in which people's managers have a slightly more equal relationship with the people that report to them.
A lot of the things you bring up, AJ, feel kind of radical ways to reimagine work. You know, certainly a co-op structure, a stakeholder structure where it's like there is no executive that's paid 15,000 times or 1,500 times more than you are. There's, you know, everybody kind of has a stake in it. I think a lot of people hearing that are like, yeah, right, that's never going to happen. I mean, that feels really far-fetched, right? But kind of a flatter management structure or just, I mean, and that's a lot of it too, right? Is what some of these labor movements are trying to work towards too, of just getting kind of a more equal stake, having a stake in it. Those are probably big longer term solutions. I think, you know, shorter term solutions are some of the things maybe that we've talked about a little bit. Some of this move towards transparency, some of the hopefully management starting to be held accountable either in an uncomfortable viral video way or in a your employees are going to leave sort of way.
I can't believe I'm the optimist here, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some truth to that and some hope that, you know, just a more honest conversation about pay and a more honest conversation about how people work and how people want to work and all of these things can help us create a world of work that's more sustainable for everybody and more equitable and allows more people to participate. So that's certainly my hope.
Well, let me end then with the smaller question of what's one specific workplace norm that you would like to change and why?
The workplace norm that I would like to eradicate is when companies post jobs with salary bands that are hundreds of thousands of dollars wide. I hate when you look at a job posting and it says, oh, we offer between 60K and 160K. And they're clearly just trying to scapegoat new policies to be a bit more transparent. So I believe in radical transparency for job postings.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I've seen even, and I think we've covered this a little bit, even wider ranges than that of like, you know, 50 or 60 to like 200 and something where it's completely meaningless. And yeah, it really leaves a lot of guesswork for the individual. Well, I'll piggyback on that one then and say the whole social norm of negotiation in all of its forms, but obviously, you know, a lot around salary. It just, you know, as much as advice that we give about it, it's so dependent on your personality and all of these circumstances that you don't control. And if there was salary transparency in a way that it's like, you don't have to figure out how to ask it the right way. We're just going to be transparent and pay everybody fairly. That would go a long way, I think. Julia, what's your workplace norm you would change?
Those fit together so nicely. I'm like trying to think of one that would.
Yours can be totally different.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, one thing I would like to see is HR just being more transparent about what they're there to do, right? I mean, I think we often, you know, this touches on sort of the salary piece, but I think more in general of like, I think a lot of employees are coming to understand, you know, that HR is there to protect companies and that's, you know, who they're looking out for. And obviously that like serves a purpose. And so I think in some ways that kind of like myth of what HR is sort of starting to be broken down a bit. And I guess I would just like to see HR be able to be a little bit more honest about what their goals are and that, you know, some of those are very much aligned with what employees want. And there certainly are, you know, a number of good people doing good work, but just some more honesty in general about kind of the role of HR and their goals and them being more open to listening to what the needs of employees are, whether that's like benefits that employees want or, you know, this whole return to office conversation. but I think just more open dialogue and more transparency about their goals and the goals of average employees would be great.
Oof, I will take that one a step further. I love the realism of being transparent as to what they're really there for, but I would love an HR, a human resources that is actually a resource to humans, because it just does not feel, you know, to your point, it does not feel that HR is there to serve the employees, because it's, you know, in a lot of functions, it's not. It's there to protect the company, but and which is a necessary function. And I almost wish, and this is maybe too radical, that there could be two. There could be the one that, and maybe they're in conflict with each other, but like the one that serves the needs of the companies, but the one that actually, as you say, as you point out, like really is a resource to employees and what they actually need, and listens and is more transparent and doesn't kind of put forth these mandates in whatever form they take and just, you know, kind of expect the employees to deal with it.
If I may.
Oh, yes, please.
If I may, Kate, I think some people would describe that second organization as a labor union.
Yes. I didn't just invent labor unions. It is actually a, you know, yes, it is actually a thing.
We invented labor unions.
All of these issues, we're hopefully going to start to think about how to solve it and start to think about how to move forward. And we're going to touch on some of, I think, you know, a lot of the things that we alluded to and touched on in this episode, we're going to go deeper on. We're going to talk about why management is so hard, why managers don't know what they're doing, why your boss isn't good at their job. We're going to talk about why meritocracy is a lie and you, people who work hard, you don't just work hard and get ahead, like kind of all of the dynamics there. We're going to really get into pay transparency and the salary debate. We're going to talk about the work week and why it's designed the way it is. We're going to talk about accessibility at work. We're going to talk about all of these things that like the problems that everybody kind of knows exist about work, how they got that way and how we can fix them. I'm sure we'll be checking back with you, Julia and AJ, at some point. Obviously, on Fast Company, we're going to be covering all of this stuff and more constantly. But thank you so much for taking time to have this conversation and kind of break it down and give us kind of more things to think about.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's all for this episode. If you're a new listener, be sure to subscribe to The New Way We Work wherever you listen. And if you like this episode, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want to hear from you. Work is changing every day. What's the most pressing issue on your mind? Email us at podcasts@fastcompany.com. The New Way We Work is produced by Julia Hsu, Avery Miles, Blake Odom, and Joshua Christensen, with editing by Nicholas Torres.